I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
Welcome to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we are going to have a very special interview with some true legends of the sport. Tony Pearson, Phil Williams, and Tom Terwilliger will all be joining us for part one of our interview with these three guys. And we had Tony, Phil, and Tom on last year, and I really enjoyed the discussion. We talked about a variety of topics. So I thought I would bring them back. So this week, Tony and Phil and Tom, we're going to talk about getting older in bodybuilding. Both, all three of these guys are over 60 years old. So I asked them about their training and how things have changed with their workouts since they've gotten older. And we also talked about the passing of Dave Draper and Chris Dickerson, who both passed away last year. And then we also talked a little bit about mixed pairs posing, which Tony was a champion in. So that will all be coming up in a minute as we do part one of our interview with Tony Pearson, Phil Williams, and Tom Terwilliger. When we get done with our interview with Tony, Tom, and Phil, I've got a part two of that Mr. Olympia article from 1981. I know it's been a few weeks since we've done the show. I think our last show was 3 weeks ago, but that was a show with David Hawk, and we had part two of our interview with David. And in that interview, I read part one of the 1981 Mr. Olympia report, which was written by Rick Wayne. So today I'm going to read part two. And this comes from the March 1982 issue of Muscle and Fitness magazine, again, written by Rick Wayne. So this will be a great article. So stay tuned for that right after the show. Yeah, we took a little bit of a break there, guys. Sorry about that. But I really could not find anybody to interview. I was looking around and I just had a few really busy weeks. And my parents came into town for about 10 days, 7 to 10 days, I think. And my brother came in town with his wife also. So I was spending a lot of time with them, and between working at Pro Physique as an online coach and then hanging out with them every night, I just didn't really have time to do any interviews. I was trying to get some people, but I could not find anybody. And then last week I did the seminar in Stuart, Massachusetts, and it was a 2-day seminar. So I was gone for about 4 days. So that was pretty busy, and that was a lot of fun. I want to thank Bruce, who is the owner of Guaranteed Fitness out in Stuart, Massachusetts, for bringing me out there and doing the seminar. First time I'd done a seminar since COVID started, so it's been a few years. Bruce is an old school gym owner. He's had the gym for 30 years, and every once in a while, he'll bring somebody out to do a seminar. He's had Mike Mentzer out there in the past and Bill Kazmaier, and he had a lot of people. He's a great guy, you know, just loves wants to help out his members, and he didn't charge at all for the seminar for the members. So it was great being out there, and he wants to have me back in November. So I'm looking forward to that. We did a 2-day seminar this time where we talked about exercise and nutrition, setting up a workout program. And we also did a special feature where I was going around the gym showing different exercises. Bruce set me up with this guy, Mike, who was a member of the gym. Mike was a huge dude, big arms. And Mike was demonstrating the exercise while I talked about each one. So that went really well. So I think the next time in November, when we do it again, I think we're going to do a 1-day seminar because I think we can fit it all into 1 day. So I'm looking forward to that. So if you guys are in the area, I will let you know about that as we get closer. So that should be probably before Thanksgiving. What else is going on? Oh, they had John Balick's 80th birthday recently. I think John was born in March like I am. So I think it was just a few weeks ago, but they put together a 80th birthday celebration, and they did a video. So they asked all these people to contribute. So they asked me to send in a video, and Arnold was on there. Who else? Rich Gaspari, Lee Labrada, Flex Wheeler, Phil Heath, Dexter Jackson, a bunch of people from the industry. So that was really cool. And I think John is going to be moving to Florida. So I'll have to find out where he's going to be, because that's my neck of the woods. So maybe I'll get to hang out with John when he comes out here. I've also been posting some videos on my YouTube channel, mostly like old school competitions. I had the 91 NPC Nationals. I put that on there, the pre-judging. I also put up a video of Tom Platz posing at the 82 Olympia. And what else did I put up there? Well, I got some old Arnold clips from when Arnold was making television appearances, promoting his movies. This was like from 84, 85. So check that out when you get a chance. It was pretty good, pretty entertaining stuff. All right. We did not get any emails, but if you guys want to email me now that we are back, you can email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right. So without any further ado, here is part one of our interview with Tony Pearson, 1978, Mr. America, Phil Williams, 1985 MPC Nationals winner, and Tom Terwilliger, who was the 1986 MPC Nationals light heavyweight winner. Here we go.
All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have three of my very special guests here with us today. We did this show last year. I thought I'd bring these guys back. So starting at the top, we got Phil Williams, who was the 1985 MPC Nationals winner. And Phil went on to win the 1988 Chicago Pro title. And then we've got Tony Pearson, 1978 Mr. America and Mr. Universe, Mr. World. Right, Tony? I get those right?
Yeah, yeah. Something like that.
And then we got Tom Terwilliger, 1986 MPC Nationals light heavyweight champion and the Niagara Fall Pro champion, right, Tom?
Oh, I didn't win the Niagara Pro. I took third in that 2 years. That qualified me for the Olympia twice. But okay. I was never able to get past. It was interesting because I competed against Al Beckles several times, beat him a few times. You know, clearly it's like hard to know when Al Beckles was actually in his prime. Because it's this was like 30 years after he'd competed in his first Mr. Olympia. But it was hard to get past Al Beckles, and he won those Niagara shows every year that I was in it.
Yeah, yeah. Al had a long career. He got better as he got older.
Yeah, it's true. He got better. I saw pictures of him in his 60s competing, and I was just a kid.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you a secret that only a few people found out. He lied about his age. He said he was older than he was. So he's actually 81 right now, not 91.
Right.
Yeah.
But still,
I agree.
Yeah.
Still, I know. When you look back at some of those pictures of Al Beckles he was, you know, he was of the actually even a prior generation that inspired the four of us. I mean, he was, you know, those old black and whites, you know, with Frank. I mean, those were the old photos from Venice Beach and stuff. And there's Al Beckles, man.
Yeah. He started in the 60s. I think he was. He won his class the first year Arnold won the universe. So that was 67. So that's how far.
Yeah, I saw pictures of him in London at those shows in his 60s, late 60s.
Yeah.
I said, oh, my God, I'm just a kid.
Yeah.
All the way to the mid-80s, you know, he's still kicking our butts up
there. I know.
Yeah.
He was Albert, you know, with his accent, he said something to me one day. He goes, whispered to me, he goes, I train very hard. Because I know you coming. I go, you damn right I'm coming.
No doubt, man. No doubt. Yeah, he was a legend. So I tell you what, it was, you know, for me, having been a fan, and I saw Albert Beckles guest pose, and I forget what show it was. I wanted to say the Connecticut. I was competing as a teenager. Okay. I don't think it was that one because that was Sergio Oliva that I met there, but I met Al at some competition. And I remember, you know, I was a kid and I asked him to flex his arm and almost knocked me out. I was like, I ran out of the building or something.
No,
right? So then to compete against them, it was just like, wow. I had no objection to losing. And maybe that's part of the reason I did.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Right.
Speaking of getting older, John Balik just celebrated his 80th birthday. The owner of Ironman.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. They did this video tribute, so they asked me to do it because I was I used to write for Iron Man, so a bunch of us all did a little video and they put it all together. A bunch of people, you know, Arnold was one of them, of course, because him and John were good friends. So I can't believe he's 80. That's amazing. But John goes back to the 60s. You know, he was competing. I think he was in the first Mr. Olympia in 1965. He was in the Mr. America part.
Right? No kidding.
Yeah, he was a pretty good bodybuilder. Yeah.
See, it's so interesting because, you know, I got to know John fairly well and, you know, I saw him quite a bit over the course of the career. And, but I never knew, I know now because I've seen pictures of him before.
Yeah.
But you don't think of him. He's just like, he's the editor in chief. That's his magazine. It's just like that. You didn't think of him as a bodybuilder.
I know.
You know, he's always in decent shape, but it's fascinating to see somebody's true history and how they got involved in the sport.
Yeah, he was from the Chicago area. He saw Sergio when Sergio first came to America. So,
wow.
Way back, you know.
Yeah.
And then great photographer, of course. He took a lot of those iconic photos, especially of Arnold back in the 70s.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So how old is everybody now? We were just talking about this off camera. I'm 59.
I'm about to lie.
I'll be the big 6-0 next year. Phil, how old are you? 62?
I'll be 62 in June.
Okay.
June 3rd. So I'm 61 right now.
Okay. How about you, Tony? You just had a birthday?
Yeah, January. I'm 65.
65. Wow, you look great. How about you, Tom?
We're all up there in the 60s, except you, John. I'm 63.
Just
January myself, Tony. And I guess, well, what's your birthday?
11th.
11th? That's my mom's birthday. I'm the 12th.
Oh, wow. One day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What are we, Capricorns? I don't even know.
We get stuff done. That's what we do.
So let me ask you this, guys. How has your training changed when you got to your 60s? Or what period, what age did it change? Where did it change right after you retired from bodybuilding? Or what point did you say, okay, I'm not going to lift the heavy weights, so I don't want to hurt myself? Or are you still lifting heavy?
I'm not lifting heavy. When I was 63, I won the Masters Universe here in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
That was a turning point for me because my body was like saying, hell no, this has got to stop. Dehydration, training twice a day. And it took a lot out of me. And I still managed to train twice a day, but at the end of that, I said, that's it.
Yeah.
Train, less weight, more reps, protect myself, just, take care of my health.
What happened, Tony? Was your joints hurting when you were doing that?
Joints was hurting. I got very dehydrated. I was cramping a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Body cramps just wore me out.
Yeah.
And I was glad that show was over.
Right. Right.
Since then, I'm still recovering from it, really. It just... After you get past 60, this is kind of downhill a little bit.
Right.
We know how to train. We know how to use less weight to still maintain what we have.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to get bigger. I'm just trying to hold on to what I have.
Yeah.
And the other part, just exercising, just being able to go to the gym and work out.
Yeah.
Those days are, squatting and leg pressing, all this crazy stuff. It's done. It's over. I don't need that. Guys look at me, oh, he's training with light weights now. Yeah. Because I did the heavy stuff when I was 19, 20 through my 30s, So it's not necessary. I mean, you got to be smart. You got to listen to your body, pay attention. Some exercises I cannot do anymore, like presses, pullovers, even dips now.
Yeah.
But you find what works.
Dumbbell now, when you were training with Robbie back in the day at Gold's, you guys were going heavy and fast, right?
Yes. That's the problem with training with Rob is the pace.
Yeah.
That's the pace. And he's looking at the clock the whole time. So you got 400 pounds and you get about 35, 40 seconds between rests if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
So between sets, I'm down on one knee, gasping. He knows the minute he puts it down, there is no talking with Robbie. I live in his house, we didn't talk. So at the gym, he's not saying a word. He just, when he puts it down, you're picking it up.
Yeah.
He was so strict. He goes, give me 12. And he means 12 because if you stop at 8, now you owe me one. Uh-huh. Nine. Now you owe me another. So he taught me some discipline. 12 means 12, nonstop. And the last rep, it'll be just like the first rep. He's really into form and technique and mental connection. I watched him for a year training in 77 when I got there, and I go, why is he training light? Why is he training heavy? Why is he doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And when I had the opportunity to train with him, I realized, he's all mental.
Mm-hmm.
He was deadlifting 500 pounds in front of me. He got it halfway up and he had to step forward. He stumbled a little bit. So he stepped forward halfway up and then he locked it. And that's when I saw in his face, I go, oh, this guy's all mental.
He's not on the weight.
So he could take a lightweight and make his arm grow.
Yeah.
Build his chest. So it's not, it's mind to muscle connection. That is so true.
Yeah.
That's when I learned that. I learned a lot from him about form, technique, focus, mental. He would walk in the gym every day and he wouldn't speak to anybody. He goes straight to the machines because his mind was set before he got to the gym door.
Mm-hmm.
There was no distraction. You couldn't interrupt him in his workout. There's no way. Because he was still a rising star at the time. He was winning, but he had a lot of tough guys to beat.
Yeah.
And, Lou Ferrigno and all these real champions. So yeah. He had to really step it to the next level to get there. And I learned a lot from him, that discipline and intensity. If you don't have intensity in your workout, you're not going to grow. You're not going to get that chisel sculpted look. Carved from stone. That's some hard work.
Yeah.
These guys are big and got all these muscles, but they look soft.
Yeah.
And a lot of free weights. Robbie didn't use machines.
Okay.
Deadlifts, T-bar, you know, you name it. Barbell curls. He would take a 120-pound barbell, curl it 10 times, and hand it to you. So how much rest are you getting? I do my set, you hand it back to him, so it never touched the floor.
Yeah.
He burned out so many training partners. They was drinking alcohol to come down. They was popping pills to come up. It's twice a day he's taking you through this hell.
Yeah.
But wow. I love him. We used to laugh at each other. We would just smile because you're not going to burn me out and I'm not going to burn you out. So here we go.
Well, I think it's interesting because, you know, that was a great question about, you know, what it was like training with Robbie. And that was around that time when, you know, I think all of us, I think Phil, you could attest to this, and John, I'm sure you can too. At some point, we encounter or find a way to attract what we need in terms of a training partner or a mentor in many respects. For me as a teenager, and even training here in Long Island, when I came back later on several years to compete in the open class, I was training at a gym called Future Man, and there were a lot of great bodybuilders there. Steve Mihalik trained there, Tony Pandolfo. There was somebody that Lou Ferrigno would come when he was in Long Island, he trained there. And so I connected with, and these guys, like Tony, I mean, this was back in those days, you know, in the 70s and in the early 80s, but it was serious training, man.
Yeah.
In fact, Robbie, it's interesting because you and Robbie, there were guys serious in California, but when I went to California, that was one of the things that kind of dumbfounded me a little bit. I'm like, these guys are having fun training. We don't have fun in New York, in Long Island, in Brooklyn. There was no fun in training. It was beat them down until he can't come back and then move on to the next training partner. So having a great mentor, like I trained with Tony Pandolfo, Mihalik for a little bit. God, Mihalik was, forget
crazy.
It. Was, yeah. I was like, the only guy I knew that could actually hang with Mihalik was my good buddy, John DeFendez, who became Mr. USA.
Yeah. Well.
But I think that's part of what made us champions in many respects,
sure,
was attracting, encountering, hanging with these guys that were so tough. So the best training partner I ever had was a guy named Gary, and he was his favorite saying, and he had these big ears. He was just like, more, 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 more. He was a psychopath. And I think he really had it out for me. He wanted to kill me. Seriously. And would do things that like completely destroy me, but it was like, I always hung. And that made me stronger. And it's definitely what led to winning the Nationals. But just to answer your question real quick, for me, it was, you know, after competing in the Olympia a couple times and having a short-lived pro career, I was mountain biking here in Colorado, and I went over the bars at about 35, 40 miles an hour, hit some rocks, broke the clavicle, 3 broken ribs, compound fractured the wrist. You know, I was 215, 220 pounds at the time. I really shouldn't have been mountain biking. You know, but I was like, I'm living in Colorado now. I got to have some freaking fun, man. I got to get out there and do some shit, not just be in the gym all the time. And so that really changed things in terms of how I was able to train. I had to retire. It forced retirement. But it really changed things in terms of how I trained from that point. It became much more about volume, speed, intensity. There were other ways intensifying the workouts without having what I have. And that's sort of what I continue to do today at 63. I'm still able to do that. My tough ass training partner now is my wife. She didn't let me get away with crap, nothing, you know, just like, I'm like, yeah, wait till you're my age. She's like, she just blows it off. Like, don't give me that shit. That's no excuse. So yeah, more volume now.
You still train the failure, Tom?
Say again?
You still train the failure at your age right now?
Pretty close. I wouldn't say it's as many sets to failure. Mm-hmm. I would say there's at least one set per exercise, or at least one set per body part. That's don't get me wrong, not Tom Platt's level of going to failure.
Yeah.
You know, but certainly for me, going to failure where it's just like the muscle's not going to get another rep. We'll do a forced rep or two from there, call it quits. So it's at least one set almost each time I do an exercise, 3-4 sets, one of them will be to failure, not every time.
Okay. How about you, Phil? I know, Phil, you never really went super heavy, even in your prime, right?
No. No, never. I trained 6 days a week from the time I was probably 15 or 16 to 18. Okay. Went to a Mike Mincer seminar, and that kind of changed everything. I realized I was overtraining. And talking to him, I started training each body part once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, once every 7 to 8 days, depending on how I scheduled it.
Yeah.
And then as I gradually got older, in the 20s, every 7 to 8 days. In the 30s, every 8 to 9 days. And at this point now, let's work up to this point, mm-hmm. I'm every 10 to 11 days.
Okay, so the recuperation's gone farther as you got
exactly, older. Yeah, of course. As you get older, you need more time to recover. So I'm training each body part 3 times a month.
Okay, okay.
But it's not very heavy. I mean, it's moderately heavy. And I still train to absolute 100% failure
on you do. Okay.
every exercise that I can.
Okay.
Absolutely. In safety.
Yeah.
So what I've done over the years is I slow down the velocity or the, you know what I mean? What I'm saying is the rhythm of the training, it's very slow, very controlled, full range of motion.
Yeah.
A lot of mental training that goes with that.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a full contraction, maximum contraction, full extension.
Okay.
So it's real slow and controlled, but it is to failure.
Yeah.
I gotta say something here because I had a chance to train with Phil once or twice. He came out to Long Island, trained at my gym Maximum out there. And man, and this is after he beat me at the Nationals, was already a great pro. And we did, when he says slow it down, he says, I've slowed it down a little bit. I don't know how you can go any slower. I mean, it was just like, it was painful. It was just like, every rep was like a minute and a half. I was like, good God, I can't. It was, I mean, seriously, it was intense.
Yeah.
Fraction of the weight I could use. Every repetition, slow, control, peak the contraction, hold that negative. And I was like, good God, I don't think I could do that every day, man. That was tough.
Yeah. That hasn't changed, Tom.
Wow.
Still the same.
Yeah.
Can't do it as often. Like I said, each body part 3 times a month.
Okay.
And after that, it's nothing but recovery.
Mm-hmm.
It takes
How about you, Tony?
To recover from those workouts.
Tony, are you going to failure too?
No.
Okay. You
know, my body allows me to do that day.
Okay.
And I keep listening to my body talking to me. It's enough. One more set, done. Don't put that weight on the bars a little bit too much. Back off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a mind game. Some days I have pretty good days. Then I have a flashback to the old school. I go, don't go there. Stay in your lane.
You know? Right.
I mean, I miss it. I got one client. He's timing himself on the watch now. He's a minute 30 a second between set. And he is so sure every day. He's like killing himself. I'm enjoying it because I'm training him, you know?
Yeah.
I go, get off this machine. Let me get some of that. Give me that. So no, I just listen to my body.
Yeah.
Sure, I'm not heavy. I don't train heavy. You don't need to. I realize you don't really need to.
No,
you need to build the foundation.
Okay.
Already there.
So you can maintain it without going heavy now.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You have knowledge. You know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So yeah.
The intensity is a matter right now more than poundage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm still holding the intensity though because I can't rest long between sets. Otherwise, I get bored. So about a minute rest between sets. I'm on. So
yeah, I was just wondering.
I think about an hour, so you can do a lot in 1 hour if you want to rest in a short period of time.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I was just wondering what your mindset was because we've all been training since we were teenagers, and now we're older. And I was wondering at what point does it change? I interviewed a guy last year. His name was Rick Newcomb. And Rick lived in California, and he's now, I think Rick is at least in his 70s. He's older than us. But he told me that, you know, lifting weights is the fountain of youth, but he lifts light weights. He does not push himself. And I was just wondering if you guys are still pushing yourself in a different way, you know, just going to lightweight. Like, what motivates you to go to the gym? Is it just, I'm just going to go train? Like Sean Ray told me, he goes, he doesn't work out anymore. He just trains. Or no, he doesn't train anymore. He just works out. He exercises. That's what he told me. Wants to burn enough calories so he can go out to eat. You know what I mean? but he's not pushing himself at all. He's always getting on me because I'm always training. I'm still training heavy. And he's like, dude, what are you doing? You're going to hurt yourself. You're going to tear something. You're going to hurt yourself. You know, Lee Haney was the same way. He's telling me, John, you got to stop lifting heavy. You know, so I'm just wondering, like, what's the mindset when you guys go to the gym? Is it just to maintain or are you still pushing yourself?
For me personally, I'm still pushing myself a little bit. Okay. And again, part of that is because, you know, this I'm in the industry and I do online products. I represent the over 40 market and what can be done, what we can choose to do. Mm-hmm. The heavy, like Tony said, the heavy is out. I've never really been that strong. Like I watch your videos, John, and it's just like, God dang, you're still pulling some weight, man. The deadlifts, the bent over rows. I'm like,
yeah,
my back would explode and it'd be over, you know?
Right.
And the little aches and pains, the accumulation of wear and tear over the years, mm-hmm. for me, the bodybuilding and certainly the martial arts has taken its toll as well.
Yeah.
Prevents that kind of thing from happening. But I still go to the gym with the idea, with some sort of distorted idea that I can still put on some muscle, gain a little bit, and I continue to do that. But I also start to see, I stay about the same leanness. I stay in, you know, the single digits area, but I have definitely seen my weight come down. It's sort of like, yeah, this time 2 years ago, you know, it was 182, 185. I'm now pushing down closer to 175. And it's just like, it just happens, man. No matter what you're doing, you're going to start to deteriorate, lose a little bit of muscle, even if you keep the hormones balanced and stuff like that. So, but I go in there, I think part of what drives me in, and it is a little ego driven. We've matured past most of that, but certainly when I go into the gyms now, and a lot of these gyms, and listen, I love the fact that there's a ton of teenagers in there. This gym that we go to is a great gym, but it's also a hangout for kids. They're training, but they train in groups of 5 and 6. They occupy the machines all day long. Yeah. They don't know what the hell they're doing. So I like that they're there and not training. Hanging out. Yeah, it's awful. You know what I mean?
Socializing, Tom.
There's also an ego. So for me, there's an ego involved. There's like, there are these teenagers out there working their butts off. And it's just like, I'm 63 years in. I go in there and it's just like, I'm in 10 times better shape than any one of these guys. Yeah. And it's like, I want to maintain that. It's not to scoff at them. It's not to say, hey, you know what I mean? It's just to maybe even show them what's possible later on, you know?
Yeah.
Right. That's why, by the way, that's why I don't train at a serious bodybuilding gym.
Yeah.
Tony, I would be looking like those teenagers over in the corner.
Tony, are you still doing the 50 reps with 135 on the squat?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Each set like 20 reps.
Oh, 20 reps. Okay.
And I don't lock out. See, I just got the 45s on the bar. When you don't lock out, you realize it gets very intense.
Constant tension.
And I'm going to like, right. So I'm doing like 5 and 5, like 10 sets, super squats with the regular squat. So
yeah,
the volume of reps like that with that weight without locking out, it's very intense. All these kids, I watch YouTube and all these places, you know, IG, and they're locking out between every rep. Mm. That's called resting, guys. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Don't lock out. Keep the tension. Feel the burn. Enjoy the pain.
Yeah.
Because every time you lock out, they don't understand. You're resting. You're resting the muscles. Continuous tension and continuous movement.
Yeah.
Right? Am I correct?
Absolutely.
No doubt. Cool.
You don't lock out. Who's resting between reps? No.
No.
Guys, if you got time to fix your hair and adjust your clothes and check your phone between sets, you're not training. No. Right. I'm going to start serving champagne because this is not a workout. I see people come to the gym. They got the gym bag, the wrist wraps, the headband, the phone, the earplugs. This is a vacation for them.
Yeah.
This is not going to be trained. We used to go to the gym like Mike Tyson, you know, no socks, no shirt, no nothing, just raggedy clothes because you're going to go to work.
Yeah.
You're going to work.
Yeah.
You can be pretty when your workout is over.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of them don't understand the concept of concentration and really pushing themselves because I see so many people on their phones immediately after the set is over. It's almost like the training is a distraction, you know,
right.
You can't wait to get on their phone. It's almost like they're not into it. You know, they're not really focused.
Right. And the concentration part between sets, you are concentrating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because between my set, I go, what did I do wrong on the last set? How do I correct it? Am I feeling the pump in the right place? There's a lot going on in my head between sets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the training. Somebody went to Gold's Gym back in the 80s, and he saw me across the room, a fan, and he says, man, I wouldn't dare come over to talk to you. Right. The expression said, don't come near me.
Right.
That's the
face. Yeah, yeah.
So if you can talk, if you can get on your phone and have a conversation, you're not training.
Yeah.
Because real training means you're gasping for air between sets.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you're up next.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. I see so many of them. It's like they're looking through Instagram. They're just, they need to be distracted. Their mind isn't on the training. They need to be distracted with their phone.
Yes.
Well, and
none of my clients, I said, leave your phone where you want to leave it because we don't need it here.
Right. Right.
And then I go, back in my day, there, you don't drink water between sets because I understand some people might need it. But if you're serious about this sport, don't drink water between sets.
Yeah.
You're there to get exhausted. Water helps you recover between sets.
Yeah.
Robbie said to me, you can drink all you want when we're done. And that's all he ever said. Move on.
And you know, what's interesting about it, the truth is, and you know, it's, you see guys out there, we have to laugh here in Colorado. It's easy to dehydrate here, but someone's out for a jog, for a 20-minute jog. They got to have 3 bottles of water with them. Like, you're not going to dehydrate in 20 minutes out running.
Right.
What about the people bringing a gallon of water to the gym with them? Like a whole big gallon of water.
Right. You're not going to dehydrate in that short period of time, man. Drink it after.
Well, I tell you guys, what you see today is when you went to the gym, Tony, years ago, we had George Turner, guys like him. Tom, you had Tony Pandolfo, whoever you started with. Mm-hmm. You had the gym owner when you went to the gym. He showed you how to use the equipment, right? Yep. And these guys go to a gym today. They go with their friends. There's no gym owner. It's a corporate facility, most likely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did they teach you how to use the equipment?
No.
They just let you loose.
Yeah.
And so I'm not surprised at the things that I see in there. They have no clue on what they're doing, how to use the equipment. They have no idea how to combine exercises or anything. They're completely clueless.
Right.
That's why you see what you see today.
Yeah.
Yes.
And there's nobody to enlighten them.
Yeah.
No. It's like the blind leading the blind in there.
True. Yeah. You know what? You know what's the most frustrating thing is that I see them all on the phone taking direction from John Defenders. I'm like, what, are you out of your mind? Let's make sure John gets that clip, okay?
Yeah. I mean, Jerry Granum told me a story about he was training at Gold's and Frank Zane, who was, you know, one of the masters of focus and concentration, right? Frank went to go to the drinking fountain and Jerry interrupted him on his way back and he wanted to ask him about a low carb diet. And Frank put his hand up and he goes, make an appointment to talk to me. And Jerry was on a low carb diet. He lost his mind. He went off on Frank and they didn't talk for like 3 years.
Oh my God.
But that just goes to show you how Frank was, you know, he was like, he wouldn't let anybody even talk to him, you know, in between sets.
Well, I tell you, most of us look unapproachable in a gym. You can come in and you can look at a guy like me when I'm training. I'm not giving you eye contact. I'm not looking your direction.
Yeah.
It's just straight line focus, like a laser beam.
Yeah.
And so, no, they know who to approach. And I mean, you can kind of see that.
Yeah.
And they feel that. So they're not going to come up and bother you.
Yeah.
It's the same when I saw Robbie training as a teenager. There's no way I'd walk up and say anything to him.
Right.
Can you imagine?
I knew better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Between sets for me, I'm kind of staring at the floor because I'm analyzing what I just did. So I'm not even looking up. I'm not looking around.
Yeah.
I'm exhausted. I'm trying to catch my breath. The next set's coming up.
You know, next set.
Your mind's, you're locked in. You can't, this is what bothers me. These kids can't go and concentrate for 1 hour.
No.
1 hour of your life, focus 100% on what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You want results. You want to get big. You want to go on stage. You got to do the work.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You got to do the work.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen overnight. I get all these kids, well, I've been training 6 months. I go, yeah, that was your warm-up set. So when do we start training?
Right.
It's indicative to a generation or two now that it's true. It is ADD. There's a lot of attention deficit. Everything's fast paced. Yeah. Look at the commercials. Look at. In fact, don't even bother looking at the commercials. We shouldn't be looking at any of the commercials. But Instagram, TikTok. If you've ever spent a couple minutes on TikTok, you can understand how this is wiring young people's brains.
To
not be, it's just, I got the next thing, the next dope of me, the next little high from my own chemical based on what might be there. What's next? What's the next surprise? They always want to see what's next and they don't have the time or the inclination or the ability to be able to focus like we used to be able to do. It was training for life. You have to be able to focus in life if you want to be successful at anything. And bodybuilding was training. And I remember we used to be asked, I mean, it was one of those things where it's just like, during your bodybuilding, how do you see this, you know, transferring into the rest of your life and other areas? The answer was always, you know, we're going to be able to be successful, be able to take this with us. Sure. I don't know if they could answer that question the same way today.
Yeah. Different time. It's a different time for sure.
TikTok is just short little reels, right, Tom? It's just like short little videos, right?
Yeah. Short little videos. And the other thing, you know, it's just like I started on it because someone said, hey, you know, you need to get in there and create a presence. So I got in and I started investigating a little bit. But I got to be honest with you. I know I'm going to sound cynical here, but if I see one more wannabe pretend badass covered in tattoos with a little bit of abs running in front of the camera like he's something, I swear to God, I'm going to kill somebody. I was like, I got to shut up. I can't take it anymore. I just can't take it, man.
Training should be like meditation, right? Like where you're
in a sense
focusing everything out,
absolutely.
Just focusing on the training and cutting out all the outside distractions. And these people are doing the exact opposite of that.
You shut the world out. You're in your zone. We call it the zone.
Right.
So you're in the zone, and nothing else matters. And you know, talk to me when my workout is over.
Yeah.
I'll call me later. I mean, we're training twice a day like this. So this is another part. These guys train once a day, and I train for an hour. No, you do that 6 days a week for 1 year straight.
Yeah.
Twice a day. I mean, that separates the young ones from the old and the real pros.
Right, right.
Yeah. it's a lot of mental. You got to be strong mentally to fight this.
And you think it would be nice to get away from your phone and get away from social media for an hour, just shut that off for an hour.
1 hour,
Go into your own world, you know.
Right. But they don't know how to find that world.
No.
That is their world. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, Tony, you called it the, go ahead, Phil. Sorry about that.
Oh, I had a trainer, Dave Washington, the first guy that trained me. He was a Missouri State champion. I started training with him at 15.
Mm-hmm.
He said, it was simple as this. If you have a problem, leave it outside the door.
Yeah.
Right? When you step into the gym. Once you finish your workout, it'll be out there waiting for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And if it's not there, then it wasn't that important.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you got a new mindset going into facing that same problem. It may have changed everything in terms of reframing it, creating some new chemical. You're all locked into these negative chemicals our body's producing over the whatever we're stressing. If we can leave that at the door, right? I mean, it just changes everything once we go back to it, facing it from a different perspective, a different mindset.
Yeah.
And Tony, you mentioned, you know, being in, what did you call it? The zone.
Yes.
Today, of course, they've reframed that. It's now, you know, being in flow. And it's very difficult for young people today to get into flow. And flow is a technical term, is a transient hyperfrontality, where the front of the brain, which is usually in our thought, it's our higher executive part of the brain where we're making decisions, setting goals, pursuing them. It's like the ability to be able to step out of that, even for a few moments, get into this flow state is an incredibly powerful place to be. And it's where we used to get. It's where we used to go when we were training, in that flow. In fact, we still pursue it. I still experience it a little bit here and there, but it's more difficult today. There's more distractions. There's, you know, even the gym we go to now with all the kids, that's a distraction, you know, to getting into that flow state. But I don't think a lot of young people have the ability or know how to make that happen. They're not working on it. They're not practicing it.
Yeah.
Well, they've never been taught, so they don't know where to pull that from.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They get a lot of it from YouTube or whatever. Like Phil said, nobody's teaching them when they walk in the gym.
No. You know, this, a lot of it comes from instinctively. You got to have it in you or you don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up, you guys read the book, and that hard work is all I knew.
Yeah.
Torture and pain. I knew that much. So training with these guys was an honor for me because my body's responding. I'm growing. You know, I'm competing and I'm training with the best pros in the world.
Yeah.
I was in heaven, even though they kick in my butt every single day.
Yeah.
I was smiling. I was enjoying it.
Right, right. Well, that's great to hear you guys in your 60s and you're still training. How do you guys all feel about being in your 60s and getting older?
Don't like it at all.
I'm not excited about it.
Yeah.
No, and I'm like, I got here too fast and I'm like, I can't believe this. When I saw that number written 65, oh my God, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you can run, but you can't hide.
Yeah.
Oh, and these young people, and you're in your 30s, and you're still Mr. Cool and the hot mamas. You're going to be 65 one day.
Right.
Get ready, because it's coming.
I know. I mean, I realize it really is difficult to embrace that it's happened this quickly.
Yeah.
And then we have that short a period of time on this earth. I mean, you know, I mean, hey, I don't know. It could be any day. It could be 115 years old. We don't really know. We do everything we can to lengthen it as long as possible. But, you know, when we talk, especially when we, remember back and lament a little bit about the past, and it just seems like I was still a teenager, you know, training in Future Man Gym. And now it's like I'm 65. I'm the older guy. You know, so the only way to embrace it, and this is something I teach while I'm working with 40, 50, 60 year olds online, is we got to create that new mindset, that different mindset, and embrace the fact that I like to use the term, we're now tribe elders in many respects. And we deserve that respect that we've earned along the way. But as tribe elders, we can't expect to want to even, you know, care to be that age anymore. But we have a lot of wisdom, a lot of experience to bring to the table.
Yeah.
Yes, we have to face the fact that we're not going to look the same, feel the same. We're going to have more challenges and difficulties. But at the same time, we should find a way to embrace this, because it's the only way to have some joy and happiness as we continue to move forward, instead of always looking in the mirror and saying,
absolutely,
fuck what happened.
Yeah. but our generation is 60 is different now, right, than it used to be, than it was, like, you know, 40, 50 years ago. I mean,
oh, 60, yeah. I mean, 60, 40 years ago, you're really old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember when Brad Pitt a couple of years ago got nominated for an Oscar, and they had a picture of Brad Pitt and Archie Bunker. They were the same age.
Whoa.
Carol O'Connor was in All in the Family. He was the same age as Brad Pitt was when he was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is he that old, Brad Pitt?
Huh?
Is he 60?
Brad's got to be close to 60. Yeah.
Well, it's amazing. I think
it was in his late 50s, and Carol O'Connor was in his late 50s, too.
Yeah. It's amazing what they can do in Hollywood, but you know, the right. What would the word be? Surgeons.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, if you can have all that work done. I mean, the tucks here and there, I mean, that makes a difference.
I mean, you know, you look at someone like William Holden, he wasn't that old, but he looked like he was 80, you know, because those guys used to drink and smoke.
Yeah.
And I think we got a whole new mindset with exercise and nutrition now, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Agreed.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, when you talk about the 60 not being the same as it used to be, look at this group right here.
Yeah.
This is a group that, you know, John, you're just about there. You're almost there. Let's not rush. But we don't look like the, well, at least to me, we don't look like.
We don't look like the average sedentary guy that's 60 years old that does nothing all day but eat snacks and watch TV.
Right, right.
We're not that guy.
Right. Drink a beer. Have a beer.
Yeah, and a few beers.
Give a damn beer.
Or a six pack. I don't know.
I'm a tequila man. I'll stick with that.
God forbid smoking.
Yeah, I was talking about that John Baylock video we put together, and he's 80 years old. It's Brady's birthday. One of the guys on the video was Jim Lorimer, who's 95 now.
Jim Lorimer.
Jim still looks in good. You know, he's healthy. He was, you know, well spoken as always. You know, so that was great to see. 95.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, you asked that question. It's just like, you know, how do we feel about it? I mean, think about the difference again. And this is if anybody's listening, that's that guy who's sitting on the couch, drinking the beer, eating the chips and aging faster than you should. I mean, that guy probably looked 65 when he was 50 or even less, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, if it's a challenge for us, could you imagine how that feels?
Yeah.
Like to be that guy who suddenly sees himself in the very 60s, an old guy.
Yeah,
he's an old guy because he's never done anything to prevent it, to slow it down.
Sure.
I mean, and how fast we got here. And all of a sudden, you really do look like the old guy. And you are the old guy. And you feel like the old guy. And it happened that fast.
Yeah,
we've got, at least we're putting up a fight. You know what I mean? I think everyone should.
Well, we're going to go out. We're going to go down swinging.
Yeah.
Going out swinging, man.
We're going to go down swinging, right?
That's all we can do, right?
That's all we can do.
Right.
That's all we can do. So every day. You know, whatever it takes to do what we need to do, get to the gym, eat well, get health screens, get health checks.
Right.
That's all we can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, until time runs out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that. I love that going out swinging. Here's the problem, though. It's just like.
And down. Then we run.
Yeah. And then the knee. And then the knee.
I heard, you know, when my back hurts, I go, why does my back hurt? And I didn't do anything. I just sat down here for a second. My back's just right. Or my knee's hurting for no reason. I didn't train leg kick.
No reason, man.
Jesus, give me a break.
I just went to the Arnold Classic, and I went to the seminar on Sunday, and Arnold will be 75 this year. Okay. And he made a good point. He said, no matter what you've done in your life, no matter what you used to look like, and he was, you know, the best in the world at one point. Sure. He said, it doesn't matter when you get old, everybody goes through the same thing. We hurt, you know, our joints hurt, you know, we get older, and it happens to everybody. So,
yeah.
True.
You are not alone.
Right. Since we last talked, we've lost a couple icons. Dave Draper passed away last fall. What did you guys know Dave at all? Because
I knew Dave very well. We were involved with Super Spectrum.
Oh, yeah.
So the owner of that company used to set up seminars, and he and I would travel together.
Okay.
I also traveled with him. We were on a plane together from LAX to Boston, where Samir won the 85 World Championships.
Okay, the WABA, yeah.
Yeah, so I was there with him, and we traveled together on that trip. And we did a lot of other traveling seminars and little exhibitions together over the years.
Oh, really? Okay.
Way back then, cool. Yeah. So I got to know Dave pretty well.
What were your thoughts of him? Yeah, he was a great guy. Yeah.
Yeah, great guy.
Yeah, I never had the pleasure. Tony, you trained out in California for quite a while. You must have had a run-in or two with Dave. I never had the pleasure.
I met him a couple of times. Really nice man. Very humble. You know, he trained hard. He was very focused on what he was doing. But, I mean, the energy he gave out, super nice guy.
Very
down to earth. You know, he didn't like the Hollywood scene. You know,
he didn't like the spotlight.
He could have been a mega star in movies.
Yeah.
He didn't want it.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of shied away from that. He loved working out. But he went into the television thing, and Hollywood was really calling for him because
in
the 60s, he had that look.
Yeah.
And
he did the film with Tony Pearson and Sharon Tate, Don't Make Waves.
Yeah.
And that could have grown from there.
Tony Curtis.
Like I said,
Tony Curtis. Tony Curtis, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he kind of shied away, and, you know, he was a very humble guy. You know, he trained with Arnold when he came over. That's my training partner. So
I think he was kind of an inspiration to Arnold because Arnold saw him in the movies and Arnold said, that's what I want to do.
Right.
And like you said, Tony, he was in the Beverly Hillbillies. He was in the Monkees. He was in the movies, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. He wasn't, I don't think he was comfortable being on stage or being in the spotlight at all.
No, he was not comfortable
very
at all.
Shy.
Very shy guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, a lot of
I remember
us.
When I talked to Peter McGuff said he thought Dave Draper was the best writer in bodybuilding.
I'm kidding.
He wrote from his soul. You know, he said he would really open up when he did his writing, and he really opened up his emotions and talked about. He wrote like several books. I think he wrote four or five books about training.
I really loved
training.
Yeah,
yeah.
I had one of his books. I read that was way back, going back a couple of decades. Yeah, so he was a good writer.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. When my book Natural Bodybuilding came out in 2005, I think I was at the Arnold Classic, and I was selling them at a table. And I remember he was very, very supportive of that. He was just a really genuinely nice guy, you know?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
Very much so.
What a legend. Yeah, it's a shame. It's a loss, you know? How old was Dave when he passed, do you know? He must have been in his
79.
Okay. Yeah, I thought he was close to 80, yeah.
I remember watching the movie. I was a kid with him and Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
We're on the beach scene, and I was like, wow. You know, California, the beach, the girl.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I remember that.
Yeah, she was beautiful, too.
She was.
Oh, yeah.
We also lost Chris Dickerson, too, in December.
Another one. Yeah.
Phil, you worked with Chris, right?
I worked with Chris.
Posing before.
I worked with Chris before the 84 USA Championships. He had a little penthouse in Venice.
Mm-hmm.
Or a loft. Let's call it more of a loft. Mm. I used to go over there and he'd help me with my posing. We'd talk. I got to know him.
Yeah.
And he was also helped a guy who came down from Canada, a guy named Doug Ross.
Oh, yeah. I remember him.
Remember him? He did real well in the IFBB universe. So Doug and I used to hang out together. We trained together and we'd spend evenings talking to Chris. So I learned quite a bit from him. So we became good friends. And that was right before he moved back to New York from Venice.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah,
I remember. when they showed the 85 universe on TV, Chris was the commentator.
He did the commentating.
Yeah. Right. And yeah. When you came out, he said he worked with you on your posing. And then you did that music to Lionel Richie.
Yeah, I stole that from him because he did that in the 80s. One of the Olympias.
84, I think, right?
84.
When he came back. Yes. Yeah.
Because in London, he used something more.
Yeah, classical. Yeah.
More classical, exactly. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I learned a lot from Chris.
Did you know
I was a big fan.
Yeah.
Big fan of Chris. I remember those pictures back in the, I forget what it was, the universe or the world or the world and the America. Boyer Co. won one show and it was the same night and Chris Dickerson won the other. And I remember seeing those pictures, man. I was a kid, you know, a teenager, and it was just like, man, I admire that. I love Boyer Co.'s physique because I had no abs either. And, but Chris, and just his physique, his legs.
Yeah.
And then, so I never had a chance to meet him until one time I was in New York training at some little no place gym in Manhattan. And I remember I was walking around the lot and I just won the teenage, was it the teenage? No, it was the Open Metropolitan Championships, the Mets, which was a big show on the East Coast at the time.
Yeah.
And walk around the locker, all of a sudden I bump into this guy and I'm like, Chris Dickerson. I was like dumbfounded, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, Tom Terwilliger. And I'm like, I was even more dumbfounded. I'm like, how the hell does he know who I am?
Yeah.
Because he was there. He was a judge at the Mets when I won, so he remembered it. But he was such a cordial, such a great guy, classy guy, man.
Yeah.
So. And great physique. I was so happy to see him win the Olympia.
Yeah. Did you ever see any of those Grand Prix that he won? Because he was winning a lot of those Grand Prix in New York, the Night of the Champions and stuff.
I never saw Chris Dickerson at Night of the Champions, but I was at several Night of the Champions, but never saw him compete there.
Okay. How about you, Tony? I'm sure you read into Chris a lot.
Yeah, I guest posed for him in New York at one of his shows. So I stayed at his house. Great guy, you know, down the earth, you know, wonderful guy. Very easygoing, laid back, you know?
Yeah.
So, great man.
And Chris was winning a lot of those couples shows before you kind of took over, right?
So right.
You know, he won 81 and 82 with Lynn Cartwright, was it? Yeah.
Was it Lynn Cartwright? Yeah.
That was the beginning of it. And then Wayne called me between flights somewhere, and he goes, there's a mixed pairs competition. We need one more couple. And I want to, you know, introduce you to Shelley Gruhl. I go,
Shelley, that was your partner. That's right.
Yeah. So that was in 82. So I went to Fresno where she lived and I hung out there for a couple of months. We got together and we came up with a routine and we won 2 years in a row.
Okay.
That's how all that started. But, you know, I trained with Lisa Lyon from the beginning.
Really?
1979.
Really?
Okay. Guest coach with Lisa Lyon. That was the first time he had a male and female flexing muscles together on stage.
Mm.
So the crowd in LA was hardcore.
Yeah,
the MNC Auditorium downtown, hardcore. The announcer had a problem introducing us because it was dead silence in the place. We have a mixed pairs guest posing tonight, and it was like dead silent. What? This is hardcore fans.
Yeah.
So Lisa and I come on stage. You know Lisa Lyon.
Yeah.
She was a celebrity. She was a sex symbol back in the
Right.
But she said, well, we had two spotlights, no stage lights, just two spotlights and a guy blowing a saxophone live.
Oh, wow.
In the background. And we put together the routine and then we got a standing ovation at the end. It was the first girl and a guy posting together.
Yeah.
Lisa Lyon, she was a pioneer. She was a tough chick, boy. She went to Gold's Gym in Santa Monica. She got kicked the door in.
So she had to step into that world. Membership.
Sign me up. And they goes, you know, women not real loud. She goes, sign me up. So Lisa started training. And then one day I walked into the gym and I looked on the wall. You had Robbie, Zine, all the pictures on the wall, Bill Grant, all these guys. And I looked up, and there was a picture of Lisa in the middle of all of them doing a most muscular pose. I said, oh, shit.
Wow.
That was Lisa.
Tony, you and I competed with you at, I think it was the World Mixed Pairs Championship. I can't, it was in Toronto.
Yes, Toronto. Remember that?
Yeah.
Toronto.
Yeah. Yep. And I was there with Gladys Portuguese.
Another beautiful lady.
Gladys Portuguese, that was your partner.
That was my partner. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
She was, I think you won that. Didn't you win that year?
We won that year.
Yeah.
I won with Carla Dunlap. I think that was in Toronto.
Was that right after Carla won the Olympia too?
Yes, it was after she won, exactly. Okay. You were in 84 and 85, I posed with
Tina Plackinger. Yeah.
Tina Plackinger, sure.
Yeah. 86, Juliet Berman.
Wow. Right. Yeah.
Right.
So, and I got my butt kicked in 87.
You were a late. This guy was a ladies' man.
It was just by circumstances that they all had other things to do and moved on and said, I got to find a new partner. It's got to
be. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. You were the king. You were the king of the mixed pairs.
No right. doubt.
For many yeah. years. Yeah.
So, Carla and I went to Nice, France in 88 and got the title back. So, that was it. They shut it down after that.
I'm going to say something completely politically incorrect, but today you could do mixed pairs with another man and not really, you know, no one would blink an eye.
Goes and wipes the sweat.
Well, I mean, that starts. It'll start out here in California, Tom.
Oh, that's definitely where it would begin.
Yeah, that's where it'll kick off.
I'm not going to touch that subject.
I know. I shouldn't have. You know, can you cut that out, man?
Because... Yeah, please cut that out. I didn't say that.
I just did a seminar last weekend out in Massachusetts, and the gym owner was a real cool guy. His name was Bruce, and he's an old school gym owner. He owned his gym for 30 years. He had a couple sons, 13 years old, twins. So he said on the last day of class, they showed the class a tape of Romeo and Juliet. Now, it was a stage production, but because of COVID, they couldn't do it live, so they had to tape it. And then they showed it like a movie. Romeo was played by a girl, and Juliet was played by a guy. This is the new world.
Weird. That
kind of sends mixed messages to kids, I would think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Totally.
Exactly.
Right?
I'm not going to touch that.
No, I know. I mean, Tony, you're doing the only right thing. None of us want our Facebook pages to be lit up tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah, but it is interesting. Now, the world is being turned upside down.
Yeah.
And there's no, you know, denying it. And there's agendas around that. You know, when you say confusing young people, and it's not even about confusing. It's about completely turning their world upside down and making things that, you know, are traditional, non-traditional anymore.
Yeah.
It's definitely changing. So when I joke about the mixed pairs thing, that may not be that far off into the future.
No. Hey, Tony, with Lisa Lyon, you got a chance to know her. What was her background? What made her get into bodybuilding when she was like the really one of the, she was the pioneer. She was the one that started.
She was the first one who started. She was going to UCLA at the time, and she was in the, is it Keno? What do you call the sword thing? What is this called?
Oh, yeah, I know what you're saying. I was going to say a keto, but I don't think it's a keto.
Yeah, but she's very big into that. And somehow that led her to Gold's Gym, I guess, to get stronger, lift weight.
Okay.
How she ended up at Gold's. And, you know, it was only one gym at the time.
Yeah, that's true.
In LA, it was Gold's Gym. There's nowhere else to go.
Wow.
So, yeah, and she made her way to the gym, and she was really strong. You know, she could deadlift. She weighed 110 pounds, maybe. She could deadlift two and a quarter.
Wow.
So she was really
strong. I knew she had an artistic background, right?
Yes. Yeah. She was an artist all the way.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anything about posing. Ken Spraggs put me up to do it.
Ken Spraggs.
He says, I want you to pose with Lisa Lyon. You won the LA last year. You're the current Miss America. You're going to post release a line. I said, no, I'm not. It's not going to happen. We're talking 1979. I go, no.
Yeah.
So he convinced me to do it. Said, okay, I'll do it. He's such a nice man. So we got together and she put together the routine. I didn't know anything about
posing. Oh, really? Okay.
I was a lousy poser myself.
You know, that's hard to believe. You were ever allowed to pose.
1979, I was rusty. I mean, first George Turner was the first guy I said, hit a double bicep pose, and I did, and he goes, my grandson can outpose you. So I knew nothing about posing. Lisa put the whole thing together. She says, we're going to get the saxophone. This is with the artistic side. We're going to get the saxophone. We're going to do it live. You know, we're going to have the spotlights on us. And I said, okay. I'll just follow along. Halfway through the routine, I said, this is a bad idea. Because you couldn't hear a pin drop. This is wall to wall. Bodybuilding was huge. I mean, it was people were starving for bodybuilding. 1979. It was brand new.
Right.
Fascinating. And now you have a girl and a guy on stage. What the hell's going on here? You couldn't hear a pin drop. Wow. Halfway through, I just continued on, followed through, hit the moves, hit the shots. The moment we stopped, it went crazy. Standing ovation for about 5 minutes. I mean, that was the beginning of, and guess what? Within a year later, there was Miss Olympia.
Oh, okay.
That's where that came from.
Yeah.
Wow. Talk about pioneers, man.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank Tony, Phil, and Tom for joining us for this episode. And next week, we will have part two of our interview with those three gentlemen. And I had a good time talking to those guys. So hopefully you enjoyed the interview. If you guys want to email me about anything about the show, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And like I said, if you want to check me out at prophysique.com, if you're looking for any online coaching for training or nutrition. All right, before I let you guys go, I want to read this article from the March 1982 issue of Muscle and Fitness magazine. And this is the Mr. Olympia report from 1981, which was probably the most controversial Mr. Olympia ever, along with the 1980 Olympia. And I was in attendance, and one of our favorite writers, Rick Wayne, was the writer. So I want to read this part two of this article. It says, the morning we left for Columbus, it was my luck to drive with Joe Weider to Los Angeles International Airport. Also aboard our flight were Roy Callender, all dressed up in his best orange World Gym web sweatsuit, a similarly attired Joe Gold, Samir Banute, Anita Colombo, her husband was already in Columbus by this time, Ken Waller, of whom little had been heard during the months preceding the Olympia, and Steve Davis. Roy's face had lost its characteristic plumpness, which supported his private declaration to me that he was at his lightest competition body weight ever, though bigger than he'd ever been in a long time. Roy sat with Joe Gold in the first-class compartment, doubtless a precautionary measure against those among the fellow travelers in the tourist section who might otherwise have tried to be neighborly. For months, Roy had existed in exile, like a caged animal within a psychological prison of his own creation. Deprived of human love, kindness, and affection, soul food, you might say, his vitiated spirit had finally succumbed to an all-consuming devil hate that by now had permeated his system. He hungered, yes, but only for revenge on those who had made this dehumanizing transformation necessary. Steve Davis had let it be known months earlier that he'd be in the 81 Olympia and smoking, but it's doubtful that any of the others took him seriously. Too bad for them, by his own estimation, Steve was by now at his very best, bigger than ever, with legs that would set new goals for Dickerson and Platts, whose underpinnings were legendary among bodybuilders. Mrs. Colombo was her usual reticent self, but after some prodding on my point, she said that she and her husband were well aware that the 81 Olympia might not be the ideal vehicle for his comeback journey. However, its unusual circumstances had made it even more challenging for Franco, who had long ago expunged the word impossible from his vocabulary. Where Franco was concerned, the contest itself paled next to the exciting idea of competing at a time when it seemed that the only cards he held were jokers. Conceivably, the last laugh would be all for the heartier for Franco. Anita said she was as surprised as everyone else by her husband's decision to return to competition, even though a psychic friend had forewarned her. Anita's skepticism had taken sustenance from the fact that Franco had re-injured his leg while filming Conan the Barbarian in Spain. But characteristically, Franco had taken this mishap as just another test of his Sardinian courage. Instead of forcing him out of the Olympia, the injury had hardened the bricks and mortar of Franco's resolve. So here we are, said Mrs. Colombo, pride lighting up her dark eyes. The leg is fine, and Franco is in better shape today than when he beat Zane at the 76 Olympia. How do you like that? If the other contenders disliked anything about Franco's return, they kept it to themselves. Indeed, they acted as if Franco had changed his mind about the contest. No one talked about him. Instead, they discussed Dickerson and Platts and absentia. And sometimes they whispered about the bait noir sitting next to Joe Gold. The consensus was that the contest would be between Callender and Platts, with Dickerson third. Eavesdropping on a sotto voice conversation between Samir Banute and Joe Weider shortly before we landed, I was delighted to hear bodybuilding's most famous reservoir whisper that he was ripped to the bone again and in the best shape of his life. And best of all, that he'd achieved such wondrous form without resorting to the naughty naughties. With everyone in the best shape of his career, it seemed that the 81 Olympia would indeed be the greatest of them all, exactly as Arnold had promised through the pages of Muscle and Fitness 2 months earlier. Whoopee. Sometime in August, IFBB President Ben Weider sat down with Oscar State to choose the men who would judge the 81 Olympia. As explained earlier, following the Sydney affair, the IFBB had decided to take full control of its contest, which is to say promoters would no longer be accountable for contest decisions, as had been the case until the 80 Olympia. However, they were still required to stage a show commensurate with the established high standards of the IFBB, and that cost money, lots of it. Arnold and his partner were expected to pay all the bills incurred by participants in the Mr. Olympia and the Mr. International contest, both of which would be staged on the same day. The promoters would supply round-trip airline tickets and hotel accommodations for judges and contenders, some of whom lived in Japan, Australia, and Britain. The bill at the Columbus Sheraton alone would amount to some $50,000. Then there was the Veterans Memorial Auditorium to be paid for, and telephone bills, security, stagehands, and so on, not to mention the Mr. Olympia prize money. Still, in 6 years of promoting the contest, Arnold and Lorimer had never lost money. From the beginning of their partnership, they had struck a deal with CBS TV that brought them $30,000 each Olympia. When that amount was added to the sums paid by various sponsors, gym equipment manufacturers, health food stores, flower shops, and other business enterprises in Columbus, it was a bundle. Small wonder that the Olympia purse had blossomed from a paltry $1,000 to $50,000 since 1975. Unfortunately, the Sydney affair had muddled the Olympia fishing banks enough to keep the big fish away. CBS had paid their money and covered the show in Australia, but afterwards had decided not to broadcast the event, as was the network's prerogative. Worse, CBS had then notified the IFBB that while their three-year contract would be honored and $30,000 paid to the promoters of the 81 Olympia, the company would not actually film the contest. Millions of fans would be disappointed. The IFBB would take another swift kick in the teeth, and once again, Arnold would cry all the way to the bank. So the president of the IFBB had every reason to be particularly careful in his choice of judges for the 81 Olympia. A recurrence of the Sydney affair would wreak inestimable damage on Ben Weider's personal reputation, the unblemished IFBB record, and the Olympia contest. With the aid of IFBB Executive Vice President Oscar State, Ben Weider picked Jacques Bloemhart of Belgium, Jim Mannion of the USA, Winston Roberts of Canada, Sven Ole Thorsen of Denmark, Franco Fossi of Italy, Dominic Certo of the USA, Doug Evans of Wales, Abdul El Giande of Egypt, and Mrs. Riko Matayuma of Japan. By Ben Weider's own estimation, they were all people of proven integrity. Roger Schwab, the well-liked owner of a sports medicine clinic in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, was elected head judge. The displacement of the IFBB's regular head judge, Bill Pearl, was never officially explained. Unofficially, however, the word was that Arnold and Pearl had a falling out as a result of a statement by Pearl following the 80 Olympia. In effect, Pearl had said during a recorded interview that Arnold's victory in Australia would have been legitimate only if bodybuilding had remained stagnant in the last 5 years, and that was not the case. The two had clashed a second time during the maligned 1980 Pro Mr. Universe contest that Arnold and Lorimer staged in Columbus a few weeks after that year's Olympia. Pearl had tried to introduce a new judging system that proved most unpopular with both contenders and audience. In fact, the idea was roundly booed by the packed house. Afterwards, as Arnold was paying out expense money to his judges, he turned to Pearl and said, "Thank you for fucking up my show." And Pearl had promised there and then never to officiate at another show Arnold organized. On September 3rd, Schwab wrote a letter to the IFBB president. It was a desperate cry for help. "Is the IFBB willing to allow two judges who have been accused of inaccurate judging in the past year to be allowed to judge the most prestigious physique competition in the world? Can we afford anything less than the very best in this year, which is so crucial to the Olympia's prestige?" The two accused less than the very best were Sven Ole Thorsen and Abdul El Giande. The first had been indicted on the ground that during the 1980 Mr. International, which Arnold stayed in conjunction with that year's Pro Mr. Universe, he had abused his position on the judging panel by voting with premeditated prejudice against Andreas Colling, the eventual winner. Thorson had given Ulf Bengstein, his close friend, a perfect score and placed Colling fourth. El Guionde, for his part, had given perfect scores to fellow Egyptian Asmat Sadiq, considerably higher than Sadiq was awarded by the rest of the judging panel. On both counts, the IFBB found the errant judges guilty of voting for their friends, and according to Ben Weider, at any rate, Sven Ole Thorsen was suspended from judging international events until such time as the IFBB deemed them fit again to resume judiciary duties. As the designated head judge, Schwab pleaded, "I am committed to officiate this competition in the highest manner. It is my feeling that the finest judging panel possible should serve the historic event. I recognize the IFBB's desire to have an international panel, and I respect this desire. Yet for the 1981 Olympia, the most qualified judges in the IFBB should serve, regardless of international consideration." Clearly, Schwab was determined not to have a repetition of the Sydney affair, not while he was head judge. He had his own hard-earned reputation as a fair adjudicator to protect, and Schwab was begging for reassurance from his president. He received a good word 1 week before the Olympia. The president assured his head judge that he shared his concern. However, Weider maintained that Sven Ole Thorsen had redeemed himself by judging honestly and correctly in London. Moreover, the president promised Schwab that Thorsen's marks would be closely scrutinized at the Olympia. At the time, Weider did not say how Thorsen, who was under suspension following his performance at the Mr. International, came to be a judge at the London show where he had earned redemption. That would be explained later. The president took the opportunity to remind Schwab of his and Oscar State's duty to assure honest judging by the panel that he had personally selected with the able assistance of the IFBB executive vice president. On the evening of October 9th at exactly 8 o'clock, Ben Weider convened a special meeting at the Columbus Sheraton. Most of the Olympia contenders were present. With Oscar State at his side, the IFBB president reiterated most of what he had earlier written to his head judge on the matter of the Olympia adjudicating panel. He assured all present that he was determined to protect the good name of his federation and would tolerate neither incompetence nor prejudice that could result in a recurrence of the Sydney story. He invited the contenders to voice any complaints or questions they might have concerning the judges. There were no complaints and no questions. Not even after the contenders were reminded that such failure to speak up in advance of the contest had resulted in the Sydney misunderstanding. Indeed, it seemed the contenders were concerned only about the way the Olympia prize money would be awarded. Carlos Rodriguez of Tucson took the floor to recommend that the money should be shared among the first 10 winners instead of the first six, as was customary. At that point, Chris Dickerson remembered that he had a pressing appointment and he excused himself. Finally, it was agreed that the money would be distributed among the first 8 winners. The awards for first, second, and third places would remain unaltered, but there would be changes in the amounts received by the other 5 winners. At this late stage, the only way that the new proposal could be accommodated. The matter of the prize money having been satisfactorily settled, Ben Weider made a further attempt to draw out any complaints that the contenders might possibly have been holding back. Still, no one took the opportunity to question the composition of the adjudicating panel. Doug Evans of Wales was unknown in this country. Perhaps he was not quite up to the required standards of Olympia judging. No one could tell for certain that this judge, who had never officiated in America before, was capable of satisfactorily carrying out his duties in Columbus. But no one queried his credentials. Mrs. Matayuma was another unknown quantity, and considering the reasons why Thorsen had found himself in hot water with the IFBB, his inclusion on the Olympia panel might have raised some eyebrows. After all, it was well known by the contenders that Arnold, Franco, and Thorsen are close buddies. No one challenged Thorsen, and no one questioned the inclusion of Franco Fassi of Italy, who's also known as a close friend of Franco. Ben Weider had promised not to tolerate prejudice, and clearly the word of the IFBB president was good enough for the Olympia contenders. Weider's assurance that there would be 2 scrutinizers watching over the judges gave the contenders further reason to look forward to a Mr. Olympia that was in keeping with the highest aspirations of the IFBB. When Franco Colombo entered the room shortly before the meeting ended, none of the other contenders paid special attention. Indeed, they went about their business while Franco shook hands with the various IFBB dignitaries. Why bother about a man who was fool enough to come out of a five-year hibernation believing it was possible to start over with the Olympia title? True, Arnold had somehow managed that little trick exactly 1 year earlier, but that didn't count. Not really. For Arnold has always been head and shoulders above Olympia realities. He'd won the title six times in a row, for crying out loud, and might have well gone on to winning for another six had he not chosen to retire. Arnold's victory in Australia had triggered an explosion, true enough, but it was nevertheless acceptable. You could live with it. But it was an altogether different proposition here in Columbus. Now you weren't dealing with established wonder workers. It wasn't as if Sergio Oliva had returned to claim his crown. Oh, no. This time, all you had was Franco. A legend of sorts, yes, but hardly comparable with Arnold. You couldn't help remembering that the one time Franco had won the Olympia, that decision had been clouded by mephitic fumes. Hell, Franco had beaten Zane by only 1 point. Anyway, lightning never struck twice in the same place. The Olympia stage had never been fertile ground for miracles. So the other contenders went about their business as if Franco were the invisible man. They saw no reason to worry about his friends on the judging panel, saw no cause for alarm. Ben Weider had assured them they would sleep well in anticipation of a good morning. The Veterans Memorial Building in Columbus was little more than a patriotic dream in 1945 when the city fathers proposed a structure to memorialize the armed forces of Franklin County who had fought in two world wars. A $4.5 million bond issue was passed to replace the aging Memorial Hall with a modern, versatile sports arena, convention site, and theatrical showplace. But it wasn't until November 11, 1955, after numerous adjustments that cost another $1.25 million, that the present building was open to the public. Today, the theater boasts 10 first-class dressing rooms, a stage that measures 135 feet wall-to-wall, and is equipped with 60 sets of lines, two spotlights, and an excellent amplification system. The auditorium holds 4,500 seats, all of which were filled by an unusually calm audience a half hour before the scheduled 10 a.m. Mr. International prejudging. There was no denying the feeling that these people had come to Columbus from all over the United States with Australia on their minds. For a full year, they had bombarded with conflicting reports of what had occurred in Sydney. For the most part, they were appalled at what they'd read in their bodybuilding journals, enough to retreat behind a collective subconscious that insisted on believing, for its own protection, you may be certain, that the Sydney affair had never taken place, pictures or no pictures. So here they were in Columbus to see for themselves whether or not the IFBB was capable of such desecration as witnesses to the 80 Olympia had suggested. They sat uncharacteristically quiet in their reserved places, not quite certain what to expect, hoping that the IFBB would not turn out to be some predatory monster capable of devouring its offspring. Indeed, there were few in Columbus who did not find themselves praying that the Sydney affair would turn out to be just another nightmare to be laughed at in the sobering light of day, that the 1981 Olympia would emerge unscarred and exactly as it had been for nearly 20 years, the established Super Bowl of bodybuilding. "Ladies and gentlemen," said Oscar Stade at the microphone, "we are about to start judging the Mr. International 1981 contest." And all of a sudden, all thoughts about Australia seemed to vanish. Loud applause shattered the uneasy silence. Reality was now in charge. The Mr. International was not without its own interesting legend. Born in Mexico, the contest was staged annually by a former Mr. Universe named Eddie Sylvester with all the rambunctiousness of a Mexican cockfight. By all accounts, it was mucho fun for all concerned, including the leading American champions that it attracted and who never seemed to tire of posing atop tables for an airborne audience powered by the combustible mixture of unbridled enthusiasm and tequila. Following the famous Schwarzenegger-Oliva melee in Tijuana in 1973, when Sergio sought to take revenge for whatever alleged misdeeds he had suffered in Germany during the 1972 Olympia, the IFBB severed all communications with Sylvester and delivered the International into the eager hands of two new promoters, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Franco Colombo. The partnership was short-lived, however. Having co-promoted the International just once in Santa Monica, California, Franco dropped out to make room for Jim Lorimer. The rest, as they say, is history. Today, the International is a prestigious affair outranked only by the Olympia. Over the years, it has attracted such star bodies as Robbie Robinson, Samir Banut, Greg DeFerro. In 1980, the International was won by Sweden's Andreas Collin. As is now the established IFBB way with its amateur events, the 1981 International would be judged according to weight classes and over three rounds. In the first round, each contestant would be checked for general appearance, symmetry, posture, muscle tone, and development. Contenders would be examined individually at first, completely relaxed from all four sides. The round would end after the judges had examined the lineup collectively. In round two, the contestants would be required to strike six mandatory poses individually and collectively, as in the previous round. The third round would give each contestant his opportunity to offer his own artistic posing routine for just 1 minute. The maximum score that each contender would receive was 20 points. During the evening show, six finalists would be chosen after careful tabulation of the points awarded in the earlier prejudging. These finalists would then repeat their free posing individually. There would be no scoring at this time. And then would come the pose down when the finalists would pose collectively. Here, judges would be required to pick their choice for first place by awarding him with just 1 point. As usual, the 81 International began with the appearance of the lightweight division. As the men strode on stage, there were the customary cheers and diverse accents from the multiracial international audience. Reg Park had loud words of encouragement for two black South Africans, never mind that he had drawn the wrath of some of the world's leading muscle men, for allegedly offering posing hints to Schwarzenegger and judging the 80 Olympia. Minutes before the reported Ben Weider meeting at the Columbus Sheraton, however, Park had denied ever helping Arnold in any way before or during the contest. He had challenged his unidentified accusers to reveal themselves. None had come forward, but Park would have much to say when the 81 Olympia was over. Park had turned down an invitation to serve as an alternate judge in Columbus, doubtless to save himself from further accusations of prejudice. He had friends in both the International and the Olympia, and Park had learned enough from the Sydney affair to avoid unnecessary attacks on his integrity. It was clear from the onset that the leaders among the international lightweights were Ray Ballou of Canada and Philip Delamini and Ralph Pierce, both of South Africa. All three were loudly applauded for their excellent presentations, and when they were called out for comparisons, the audience vociferously acknowledged the obvious competence of the adjudicating panel. Oh, yes, Olympia Day was off to a good start. Shigeru Shigeta stood out among the middleweights, but this hardly meant he was in for an easy time. Not with such tigers as Henry Cocker, Lawrence Brazil, and Pat Layoff snarling at his heels. Shigeta, a first-class representative of Japanese bodybuilding and a former winner of the NABBA Mr. Universe title, had decided finally that the IFBB would serve his talents better than the British organization. The light heavyweight division sparkled with big names: Billy Arlen, Bob Jockiewicz, Les Galvin, Charlie Thomas, Ali Mala, and Darcy Beckles. Thomas and Mala had made particular improvements in the last few months. At one point during the prejudging of this class, a visibly surprised Wag Bennett turned to me and said, "I can't believe the standard. Anyone here could win the NABBA Universe," a statement that said much more about the London contest than was immediately obvious. As you watched the Mr. International Heavyweights in action, you couldn't help thinking that here indeed was one difficult act to follow. With the likes of Rod Kuntz, Larry Jackson, Bob Reese, and Scott Wilson on parade here, the Olympia contenders would have to be their best to avoid being outclassed. Jackson brought dinosaurs to mind. This man seemed to grow before your eyes. Kuntz, a most affable young man, even in the heat of competition, was bigger and more cut than usual. He's destined to go far in bodybuilding. Scott Wilson had deliberately missed this year's American Bodybuilding Championships to prepare for the International. Well, now he was certainly ready. Suffice it to say that the audience reaction throughout the international prejudging had never been better. Every contender received enthusiastic support from the packed auditorium. Oscar State was his normal punctilious self as he kept over-anxious contenders in line, and he received his usual quota of good-natured boos from the audience. Roger Schwab, the head judge, did his best to fulfill his commitment to officiate in the highest manner. By the time the prejudging of the international was over, all thoughts about Australia seemed to have evaporated in the heat of the moment. The international had been a most effective appetizer. Now the guests of the IFBB were hungry for the main course. But first, there would be a 15-minute intermission. Backstage, Arnold Schwarzenegger was keeping his mind strictly on business, which is to say he did his best to avoid mixing with the competitors. When I tried to engage him in conversation about the Olympia, he insisted on replying in German. Another time, a friend feigned deafness when asked whether he thought of Franco's chances of pulling off a miracle that day. Bill Drake was courageous enough to be thankful. "I don't know about anybody," he says. "Franco's my buddy, and I hope like hell that he wins. I'm rooting for him, but there are some monsters in this contest." I had not expected to see Mike Katz in this jungle. A titan in his heyday, Mike had turned his back on IFBB bodybuilding for a few years to protest against what he had said, in effect, turned into chemical warfare. In fact, Mike, who was one of the leading stars of the IFBB during the late 60s, had gone so far as to join the ranks of Chet Yorton's anti-druggies movements. Mike had actually competed in one of Yorton's Mr. Natural America closedowns, or was he only a guest star? I hasten to add that the Mr. Natural referred to is open only to bodybuilders who can prove to Yorton's satisfaction that steroids have never been a part of their regular diet. The contest has nothing to do with the hairdressers. Mike had earned a reputation of sorts for his regular attacks on bodybuilders who use drugs, and he often threatened to stay out of such events as allowed participation by the unclean. But there he was in the 1980 Pro Mr. Universe contest up against the likes of Tom Platz, Joseph Wilkos, Albert Beckles, and Greg DeFerro, none of whom who has ever been particularly fastidious where effective nutrition is concerned. Frankly, at the 80 Universe, Katz was like a kamikaze mouse with a divine window. He appeared emaciated, thin, not lean. This man, whose name had once been a synonym for gargantua. In a house ruled in turn by Scott, Oliva, and Schwarzenegger, Mike had always sat near the head of the table, close to the kings. But here he was little more than a court gesture. He had set out to prove that you didn't need drugs to develop a great body. Well, by the evidence he offered last November, the matter still remains to be proved. The Mr. Universe jury had no trouble arriving at their unanimous verdict. Case dismissed. But clearly Mike had not been satisfied, for here he was again in Columbus to appeal. "Take a good look at me during the prejudging," he said when I encountered him backstage. "Then let me know what you think. I may not always agree with what you write, but I know you're honest." There is no finer gentleman in bodybuilding than Mike Katz, and no greater glutton for punishment. Dennis Tinarino had decided to throw in with those who had sworn to boycott the 81 Olympia, but with the new turn of events, he had found himself without a cause. And since he was, by his calculation, in the greatest shape of his life, he had decided at the last minute to follow the former protesters. So here he was, more than ever determined to take the title that inexplicably, where he was concerned, had eluded him for 4 years. Once Dennis had been as famous for his temper as he was for his championship physique. Lately, however, he had transformed his personality. He had settled down with his wife, Anita, and their two daughters in Northridge, California, after becoming a born-again Christian and discovering that life is a journey, not a destination. The new Tinarino had found success in business and in his personal life. He was a joint owner of a thriving gym equipment store in Westwood. For a while, Dennis had given support to the anti-steroid movement, but in the more recent times, he'd gone quiet on that issue. Indeed, if he still retained an interest in politics, it was now a secret that Dennis kept to himself. Evidently, this new lifestyle was paying off. This Dennis tipped the scales at a hard 235 pounds, and it was obvious as he pumped up backstage that where the other Olympia contenders were concerned, he planned to be devilish. Carlos Rodriguez was his usual unruffled self as he waited for the call to arms, and Ed Corney, his thick mane now gray all over, spoke hardly a word. Once as much discussed was Arnold, Franco, Robbie Robinson, and Mike Katz, with whom he starred in the movie Pumping Iron. His image on the cover of the book was considered a major factor in its success. Ed had been in seclusion during the last year. You heard various stories about his involvement in the San Francisco nightclub that was doing quite well, but there was hardly anything about him in the magazines these days. Roy Callender remained in sequestration with his wife Maggie and their offspring, and no one seemed to know or care exactly where Franco, Platz, and Dickerson might be found. Steve Davis had nothing to lose. He walked around backstage strutting his hard stuff like a peacock with hens on its mind. Johnny Fuller was in a black mood. He had shaved his head for the occasion. That was the first thing you noticed about him, and he gained weight. But you couldn't be sure what he had contributed to his lack of self-confidence or the loss of his normal joie de vivre. He enjoyed a good year at the Grand Prix circuit. He should have been in a mood for action, but he wasn't. When I inquired about the whereabouts of Samir Banute, some smartass said Samir had probably sprung a leak. I was still trying to discover Franco's hideout when a familiar English voice sounded backstage, "Will you please take your seats for the prejudging of the 1981 Mr. Olympia contest?" You got the feeling that when he wasn't using it, Oscar State stored his voice with the fish in his deep freeze. They marched on stage like warriors from a world that had never known defeat, a world where only number one mattered. Here indeed was irrefutable proof that all men are not created equal. Fuller, Padilla, Banute, Davis, Waller, Wilcosh, Walker, Corny, Colombo, Callender, Katz, Platts, Tinerino, Dickerson, Ratty, Metz, Rodriguez. The list read like a roll call on Mount Olympus. 17 in all, each number one in his own book, each determined to prevail. Never before had a higher standard of Olympia champions appeared at the Veterans Memorial Auditorium, and the audience was quick to pay its respects with an ovation that must have been heard on the top floor of the Columbus Sheraton a mile away. There was a feeling that the audience was also congratulating itself for being prescient enough to see through the dark prognostications that only second raters would appear in the 81 Olympia. Reg Park put his fingers to his lips and blew a whistle sharp enough to deafen bats. If there were any who had come expecting a wake, they had quickly changed into their party clothes. Right from the start, the action on stage was explosive. Whoever had been reckless enough to place Callender and Franco side by side had cause to reevaluate his sanity. For even before the prejudging began, Callender had started out to stuff humble pie down Franco's throat. "Look," said Roy, pointing to his extended left leg. "Look," 8,000 eager eyes quickly focused on the finely carved chunk of ebony that Callender had moved alongside Franco's vulnerable left thigh. The Sardinian had never been a lover of pastry. "Look," he said, pointing to the mess of squirming snakes in his flecked pectorals. But Callender had brought along more heavy artillery. "Look at that," he fired off from Franco's face. "And that, and that." Throughout the exchange, pandemonium had wreaked havoc in the audience. Oscar's frigid tone soon brought the chaos under control, but not before the audience had retaliated with its own round of heavy boo bombs. A pattern had been set. The Olympia had never been a tea party for geriatric war veterans, where you sat legs together, hands upon knees. If over the last few years some old fuddy-duddies had tried to turn bodybuilding Super Bowl into a convention of nuns, it was time to call a spade a spade. The Olympia had always been a rough-and-tumble battle that only the fittest could survive. So Oscar or no Oscar, the fans would make the 81 Olympia the unruliest, most exciting, memorable in the contest history. And the judges would give the crowd every reason to rise and mutiny. But that will wait until next month. All right. Good long article by Rick Wayne about the 81 Olympia. I didn't realize there was a part three, but we will have to wait until next month to read part three of the 81 Olympia. All right, I want to thank everybody for joining us for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We'll be back next week for part two of our interview with Phil Williams, Tony Pearson, and Tom Terwilliger. Until then, train hard, stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.